Okay. So Tsitsavin has a an irony. As the Midrashic tradition points out, yeah.
I don't think any of the healing are made out of iron.
Boy, that was terrible, Adam. That was terrible. So, right, the Midrashic tradition is very enamored with the idea that there is a word that is missing from Tzitzava that is not missing from any other parsha, starting at Shemot, and that is
Moshe.
Right? The Midrashic tradition is very into this. Which, okay, I mean, fine. You know, obviously in Pshat, you could deal with this in many ways. But the Midrashic tradition is very into this idea that there is no Tzitzavah. But Aviva Zornberg points out something fascinating, which is that's true, except it's also one of the parshiot in the Torah in which Moshe is drawn attention to the most. Okay? Why? Because think about how it reads. It's true, Moshe's name is never mentioned, except, even though, remember, Moshe was already commanded to tell the Jewish people to build the Mishkan in Truma, Tetzaveh, you get all these, V'ata Tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael v'ikhu elech Hashem en zayitzach chazit lama'or lalot ner tamid. You will command the Jewish people. Now that's a bit weird, meaning Moshe isn't doing anything. The Torah, like, zeroes in on Moshe only to say that you command others to do something. And then, in an even weirder one, just a few psukim later, most of the parsha is about the Kohanim and the Big Day Kahuna. So you would say, aha, it makes sense. Parsha Tzitzaveh, in which Moshe's name isn't mentioned, it's about other people getting the spotlight. But it's not. Instead, what do you get? You are responsible for finding the Kohanim and making them Kohanim. So, on the one hand, Moshe's name isn't mentioned. He's not in the spotlight. The whole parsha is about giving other people authority and giving other people tasks, except you get a lot more vi'ataz than we do in pretty much anywhere else in the Torah, right? This is not a phenomenon that we find that often where God, like, over and over says, and you are responsible for doing this. Often it's daber el b'nei Yisrael, rather vi'atah, right? It's like, so on the one hand, Moshe's name is absent. On the other hand, when Moshe shouldn't be center stage, he clearly is. Right. In fact, it's weird. Often, why do we expect Moshe's name all the time? Because we expect the pasuk "Vaydaber Hashem Moshe Lemor," which is in third person. And the only reason we don't get Moshe here is because that's replaced for the in-your-face "Ve'ata." Right? It's like, sure, if I'm talking to you about Rabbi Ginsburg, then his name comes up. If I'm in a conversation with Rabbi Ginsburg, it might not come up because I'm just talking to him. Right? So the only reason that Moshe's name is not mentioned is because he is front and center in a way he isn't elsewhere in the Torah. And that's weird because the context that is Dafka where he is not center stage. It's you pick the Kohanim and give them the task. So even within the Midrashic world that you make a big deal of the fact that that Moshe's name is not mentioned, it's weird because he's very present in the appointing of the Kohanim. So what do you do with this, right, with this phenomenon? She notes that this becomes the Balaturim's comment at the beginning of the parsha draws attention to this in an interesting way, right? He says, "Vatatzitzaveh." So he quotes the Midrashic tradition. V'lo hizkir Moshe b'zeh ha-seder, ma'she'en gen b'chol chumash, shemisha shenolad Moshe ein seder shlo huzkar ba. On the one hand, this is the only parsha without Moshe. Why? V'atam yishum sh'amar mecheni na misefach ha-shar katafta, right? The reason in the Midrashic tradition is because since next week's parsha, he says, erased me from the book. So God says, I want to erase you from the book, but I'll erase you from a parsha. Ukilat chacham afil al tanai ba, and when a chacham curses, it has to come true in some way, even if it's for no reason. Va'o dizua parasha medaber betachsi seikuna umi Moshe itakuna hagdola latzeit. So then he says, I have another reason, and this is what highlights it. He says, why is Moshe's name not here? Because it's the parsha of the Kohanim, but Moshe should have been the Kohen, and he wasn't, which is a different Midrashic tradition, right? You know this tradition, right? When did he lose it? It was taken from Moshe and given to Aaron. So his name was not mentioned because of the pain that he felt that he was now had to give over the kahuna to Aaron. So what exactly do we do with, right? So what exactly do we do with this? And she notes, by the way, that this is not just in the Kohanim. The Ramban actually says, why is it that Moshe said vata in the beginning of the parsha that you have to be involved in the oil? The Ramban suggests that maybe this is the mitzvah that Moshe is meant to take most personally, right? He, for some reason, has to be left, right? He personally is responsible for the oil. Right. So what? So she writes. So it is in this Moses free text then that is introduced by three occurrences of the emphatic address to Moses. And as for you, the paradox is compelling: absence and presence, anonymity and insistent naming. Moses' role becomes both conspicuous and problematic. Another way of refocusing the paradox is to notice that the parsha is almost always read during the week in which the date traditionally associated with Moses' birth and death occurs, the 7th of Adar. The tension set up between absence and presence is reflected in a liturgical dimension which evokes the mystery of a life that ends on the same day it begins. Right? So I think that in the Midrashic world, this is actually a very powerful paradox that needs explaining. So what do you do with it? So this is really her entire chapter on Tzitzava in many ways is dealing with it. But let's at least touch on the issue. So she quotes the following midrash, which highlights it in a very powerful way. Okay? As for you, you shall bring forward your brother Aaron. It is written, if your Torah had not been my plaything, I should have perished in my poverty, right? Etc. When God told Moses, as for you, you shall bring forward your brother Aaron, he did him an injury. God said, I had possession of the Torah, and I gave it to you. If it were not for the Torah, I should have lost my world. This is like a wise man who married his relative, and after 10 years together, when she had not borne children, he said to her, seek me a wife. He said to her, I could not marry without your permission, but I seek your cooperation. So said God to Moshe, I could have made your brother high priest without informing you, but I wish you to be great over him. Now that is a wild midrash. Because what does it say? Moshe is the beloved wife. Moshe is the beloved wife. And therefore, after 10 years, she doesn't have kids. Really, by right, God could just divorce the wife. But he doesn't want to because Moshe is the beloved one. So what does he do? He says, Right? It's like a husband saying, I love you so much, but you haven't had kids. Do me a favor. I'm putting you in charge of finding me a new wife. Right? So too, God tells Moshe, I want you to find your replacement. So you are in charge of appointing Aaron. Right? So that Midrash seems to be picking up on exactly this paradox, that choosing Aaron is, on the one hand, the most anti-Moshe thing on the other hand, in the whole world, but Moshe is the one chosen to pick his replacement. It's like telling a barren wife who's beloved, I want you to do me a favor and find your replacement. Right? Adam's looking at me like, wow, that's weird. Right? Right? And as she writes, the analogy invoked in this midrash is startling. Yeah, I think that's fine. I think that's definitely fair. So what exactly? So what do we do with this? So there are different things, and again, her whole chapter is on this, and it's really a fascinating chapter. So you could go in different directions, right? One is to say that the combination of these highlights Moshe's definitional role as the paradigmatic Anav, right? Right, is to say, yes, this exact paradox draws attention to the fact that Moshe is Anav Mikol Adam. The fact that he can handle this, right, is what highlights who Moshe is. Right? So that's possible. But there's another element. And here she notes yet another midrash. We're at the burning bush where he said, where Hashem calls to Moshe, and then Hashem says, don't come any closer. The midrash reads it as, don't come closer, meaning you think you deserve to be king and to be Kohen. But you're not going to be. You'll be Kohen for a week, and you'll be king for a little bit, right? Vayhi Bishur and Melech. But basically, you're not really going to be either king or, right? For a little bit you will, but not fundamentally, right? Al tigrav halom. You deserve it, but I'm not giving it to you. So what she notes is that it may be not just his humility, but almost the fact that Moshe's life needs to be defined in the Midrashic imagination as one of frustration, where it is, in a certain sense, wildly successful, and in a certain sense, sterile. Right? Because what does he not get? Right? What in the imagery of the Midrash, what does he not get? He's the beloved wife, but the sterile wife. It's, and she knows this is a trope throughout Tanakh. The sterile wife is the more beloved wife. Right? The one who is most in the relationship. Sarah is sterile. Hannah, sterile. Right? The beloved wife is not necessarily the productive wife, meaning the person with whom the relationship is strongest, because it is so strong, it can't necessarily continue past them. In a certain sense, that may be the irony of Moshe, right? That his relationship with God is so unique and so radically powerful that it doesn't actually lend itself to greatness, which is expressed in what way? Dynasty. Right? Rule, kingship and kahuna are closeness to God that are about family, that are about the ability to pass on. But the irony of Moshe, right, his children, frustrating enough, don't become leaders. And in fact, the most powerful spiritual leaders in Tanakh fail in this regard. Right? Because who in Tanakh is equivalent to Moshe? Shmuel. And Shmuel has the exact same problem. Right? That he wants to have a dynasty and God frustrates him. And therefore, it could be that this is part of what it is, right? Is that it's not just that he's humble, but it's that Moshe at a certain level is so great that by right, yeah, he should be Kohen, right? But he specifically can't be because his relationship is so unique and so powerful and so intense, right? that it can't be passed on. He is the beloved but sterile wife, right? And that's like his definition, right? That is his definition. He speaks panim el panim. That's what makes him who he is. But it's specifically because of that he's responsible for handing over Kedusha. He's very much in the mix, but it can't be passed down to his own children. So the second element of it is that, right? One might just be his humility, but the second might be that, no, this paradox is really what defines Moshe, right? That he is the one most intimately involved in creating the structures for the Jewish people because he's medaber panim el panim. He has an unparalleled relationship with God. But it's specifically that that makes it that he can't pass it on because that lower level Kedusha can be inherited, right? But when it's that unique and that powerful, it's personal, right? It's personal and can't be passed on. And she knows that this in many ways is like the tragedy of Moshe's life, and especially in the Midrashic imagination, where, right, he begs, right? In the Midrash, when does Moshe totally break down? When God tells him, I want you to tell Aaron he's dying and give and help him pass on the kahuna to Elazar, and Moshe breaks down, right? Because he says to Aaron, you are lucky that you get to see your child take on your role. I wish I could do that. And he begs God to have the same death as Aaron, but he never gets it, right? Instead, unlike Aaron, who gets to die while passing on his kahuna to his son, Moshe is buried by God himself where no one will ever find him, which is like the fitting end to Moshe. Right, Aaron gets to die and be mourned by everybody while he passes on the children. Moshe gets buried by God because God is really close to him, but no one will ever know where he is, and his children don't become leaders. Right, this is like the story of Moshe's life, and I think as a read of the Midrashim around Moshe, this is a beautiful, beautiful read of the way the Midrash imagines Moshe. Right, that. Again, that he's the sterile wife, right? He's most intensely involved. Ata, ata, ata. I'm not going to mention your name because we're so involved. But it's Dafka that makes your name be forgotten, right? Or not your name be forgotten, but makes it that in a certain sense you can never pass it on. Your identity is lost. Because what makes Moshe unique is what makes it that is the exact same features that make it that Moshe's identity can't be passed on. Because that type of intimacy is just intensely personal. And that's the success and tragedy of Moshe's life. So I think that is just a beautiful, beautiful midrashic read of Moshe's life. So, again, she goes into great detail, but I think just the general point is very, very powerful and just a brilliant, brilliant read of the way the midrashim view the tragedy of Moshe's life. Okay.